Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This is the hour we spend taking stock of how our lives have changed this week and what happened and why it matters. And from The Stranger, we have news reporter Sydney Brownstone. Hi, Sydney.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas, welcome back.
Hello, Bill.
King 5 political reporter Natalie Brand, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of you. Topic number one, of course, is the swirl around Seattle's mayor. By the way, we're live tweeting this show at KOW, so hop in on it. The swirl around Seattle's mayor this week, the Kent man who is suing Mayor Ed Murray for alleged rape, became more than a set of initials. Delvon Heckard came forward, gave interviews. His photo is public. Here is Mayor Murray's reaction to Delvon Heckard coming forward. Notice the mayor mispronounces his name.
I just learned this morning Hackard's name and can say that his name is not a name that is familiar to me. Is it possible that I have met this person before? Sure, it is possible. I've encountered thousands of people over my 3 decades as an activist and as a public service. I cannot say for certain that I've never encountered him at some point in those many 30 years, at a time when I was very publicly active and civically engaged. But again, let me be clear, I have never had sex with Delvon Heckard or any other minor at any time.
Delvon Heckard, the accuser, told the Seattle Times that he has no reason to make this up.
How would I know how this apartment looks? How would I know the time frames? How would I know his phone number? Still till this day, there's records that I've called, I'm sure, that I've called him from jail and from prison. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how far they can go back, but what's somebody going to sit up and make up some? Well, I mean, people do things like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm not sitting here wasting these people's time and wasting my time. I mean, I'm trying to heal from this. I mean, I'm going to sit up here and make up some stuff like that.
Sydney Brownstone, you think knowing who Delvon Heckard is changes things?
I think it's really significant that all three accusers right now are using their full names. It's journalistic convention in rape allegations and reporting on rape to not use the name to protect the victim from stigma. There's some debate around that and whether that ought to change. But using your full name on the record, it significantly changes your exposure in the present and in the future. I mean, anyone does a Google search going forward, your name is going to pop up. I can't see what Delvon and Jeff Simpson and Lloyd Anderson would have to gain from using their full names in this situation, especially because in Jeff Simpson and Lloyd Anderson's case, their claims are past the statute of limitations. So there's nothing for them to gain financially.
As I've said many times, and it's important, the mayor categorically denies all of these allegations. C.R. Douglas, you also think that that Delvon Heckard having a name and a face and being public changes the dynamic.
I think it's huge, and I think it's why the mayor had a very bad week. I mean, things got worse for him, not better, on this front. When you have a name and a person telling the story in their own voice, and you heard just a bit of that, it really changes things. I mean, you listen to him, and you can tell he's had a hard history, drug problems, in and out of jails, things like that, but there's also an earnestness there, And he does sound credible. Now, he may be a great con artist, but it strikes me that if you pair him with Jeff Simpson, the Portland accuser who's done quite a few interviews, you start hearing the stories in their own words with graphic details, and it makes it a lot tougher for Mayor Murray to debunk this. Not impossible, right? But tougher when real people come forward.
Whether the stories are true or not makes it tougher. Natalie, what do you think?
What was striking to me is we heard from the mayor this week. It was actually following the tree cutting settlement news conference.
Which we will talk about in a few minutes too.
But they cleared the pictures of the trees and they transitioned to the mayor reading the statement about the allegations. So that was right, you know, within that same hour. And then the mayor took questions and he gave quite lengthy responses to several of our questions from, you know, why do you think these alleged victims are lying, to are you going to still continue to run for re-election. And he's adamant that he's, you know, running for re-election. He's continuing his city business. He attended a mayoral forum last night following a police shooting where he appeared in his official capacity as mayor. And the allegations were not raised for obvious reasons because the city was dealing with a police crisis at the time. So it's interesting that we continue to see this mix of the mayor serving in his official capacity while also battling these allegations and separating the two.
I think it's also notable, I mean, as Natalie said, the mayor did talk at a press conference, but he also for the first time did one-on-ones with all the TV stations, sat down, answered questions directly about this in his home with his husband sitting next to him. And I must say that was a big event. There was, in basically all the interviews, kind of a lifelessness, if you will, a lack of energy. I was surprised by that. I mean, he's not a super charismatic guy, but you would have expected some more passionate outrage if you are accused of such heinous things and you think it's false. So I'm not saying it's true, but I don't think the interviews he gave were probably enough to convince a whole bunch of people to start coming on his side. I mean, you have yet to have anyone really come out and defend him. You have Sally Bagshaw, the city council member, who did make a statement that she has faith in the mayor and faith in what he's doing for the city. I think that was almost her exact quote. But nothing, didn't go anywhere near saying these allegations are false, these guys can't be trusted, it's a right-wing conspiracy. I mean, all the kind of stuff the mayor's saying, no one has come forward to join him on that.
But are his allies leaving either?
No.
They aren't leaving yet, but the silence is pretty notable.
The silence.
He has not made the case yet.
I was going to add the silence is extremely notable. And at this point, no endorsements of the long list of endorsements have been pulled. I can't even get statements back yet from some of the key, you know, elected officials in the state, including the governor, as to whether or not their opinions could change.
Sydney?
I wanted to add something to what CR was saying about the mayor's televised interviews not getting him off the hook. I completely agree. I mean, it's also noteworthy that the mayor to this day, or the last time I checked, has not accepted an interview with the reporters at the Seattle Times who initially reported the story. And in a scathing editorial that was published in my paper, he just attacked these other reporters. In addition, I've had the opportunity to interview two of his accusers, and when I reached out to his lawyers and his PR or his publicist and asked for a comment from the mayor, I didn't get direct comment from him. So it seems like the mayor is still not subjecting himself to the type of questioning or rigorous questioning that at least I would like to see. The other thing I'd like to add is after sitting down and speaking with these accusers, I came to this conclusion. Either they are the most gifted, pathological liars and students of complex childhood trauma that I've ever met, or they somehow believe what they're saying, or they're telling the truth. And that became particularly apparent to me last night because one of the accusers, Lloyd Anderson, who has stayed out of the spotlight in recent days, he called me up earlier this week and told me that he was ready to talk. And we did an interview, and I had fact-checked it with him yesterday. It ran this morning. And he hadn't seen the televised interviews with Mayor Murray. And he called me up last night. I was at dinner with my boyfriend and his dad, and he was furious. He was upset. He was so upset. He was saying, let him say that to my face. Let me go there and let him say it to my face. And that emotion was real. And same when I went down to Portland to interview Jeff Simpson, when I asked him where he feels his trauma today, and he told me he felt it in his chest, and then a depressing gloom that would come over him, and his eyes started watering. I mean, again, like either he's an incredibly gifted actor, should receive the Oscar for acting, or he's telling a version of the truth.
Well, listen, this is very weird because we have categorical denials from someone saying this didn't happen and none of us know. Do you feel any compunction about you're giving your opinion about emotion that seems real to you? A lot is at stake. I just sort of want to check in with you all. This is a very difficult story to report. Right? Do you feel How conflicted are you about talking about this?
Well, I agree it's a difficult story to report, and you want to be fair to all sides. And people can, you know, be good, they can fake out a reporter, let's just say that. So we ought to be suspicious when allegations come from these kinds of people this long after the fact. They did get some of the details wrong, it seems, or at least, you know, this idea that he's got some defining mole in his genitalia, you know, Ed had that checked out. Now that was his doctor. They'll get an independent doctor and we'll see more about that. But so listen, there's reason to be suspicious and there's reason not to jump to conclusion. But it's also the case that I don't think Ed has yet given the people he needs the confidence to come forward and say, we're all with you full square. I mean, among other things, he talks about a vast right-wing conspiracy. Well, you listen to these guys. First of all, the man filing a lawsuit, a gay black man, drug problems, kind of homeless, been in and out of jail. I mean, he does not strike me, when you look at him or his profile, as some right-wing conspiracist or some pawn of the right wing, nor does Jeff Simpson. So that claim, which is central to Murray's allegations.
We should
here,
say more about that. That this claim is that this law firm, is it a founding partner in the law firm, also donates to anti-LGBTQ causes?
Yeah, he donated quite a bit to the effort last year and this year to keep transgender kids out of bathrooms and that are consistent with their gender.
But really the conspiracy is starts with Jeff Simpson, mm-hmm. if you talk to the mayor. I mean, the mayor's people and the mayor has said very clearly that Jeff Simpson, the Portland accuser, mm-hmm.
Who the mayor does acknowledge knowing very well.
Acknowledges being a foster parent
right.
to him. 10 years ago, he's made these allegations for a long time, and 10 years ago was making them again in about 2008. This is the crux of the mayor's point. And he was calling legislators, calling, you know, journalists, calling all kinds of people, faith community leaders, all the rest, trying to get this out.
And he said he did that in one afternoon. He says that he called 4 or 5 pastors on the same day and just whoever popped up in a Google search and Ken Hutcherson.
Yeah. And so one of them he called, and is what the mayor makes a lot of mileage out of, is Ken Hutcherson, who was a, you know, rabidly anti-gay pastor, has since passed away. But that he was one of the people he called, and Hutcherson sort of took the story and did what he could with it, wasn't able to do much because it never surfaced. But the fact that there was sort of one contact from Jeff to him, not from Hutcherson to Jeff, suggests that the right wing must be behind this. And that it's Simpson, the Portland guy, who recruited DH, the guy up here, that it's somehow Simpson that also recruited the other Portland guy. So that this starts with Simpson, the conspiracy. But the problem with that thesis, maybe it's true, but the mayor needs to explain why Simpson doesn't know DH, why DH doesn't know Simpson. They didn't know about each other's allegations. They claim that this all came independently. So if there's some grand conspiracy starting with Simpson, which is the mayor's point, it has not been proven.
Also, if you ask Jeff Simpson and Lloyd Anderson about their views on gay marriage, they're not anti-gay marriage. If this is entirely political, wouldn't they be using this moment of publicity to get out their views about gay men and pedophilia and whatnot, whatever false excuses were used to, make gay men seem like awful people?
I think what's important, what's critical is, in terms of what happens next, is the legal process. This is now, these current allegations is part of a civil lawsuit. And so we're going to go through a legal process with depositions and discovery. And that did not happen in the case of Jeff Simpson, who an attorney was hired by both sides. And the case never moved forward because the attorney hired by the mayor using campaign surplus funds, which is a whole different story, which cannot be investigated right now by the PDC because of a statute of limitations. That attorney raised questions about not only the alleged victim's credibility, but also that the case was time barred because the rules, the law in Oregon is different than the law here when it comes to statute of limitations.
And then Jeff Simpson's lawyer came forward in the last couple of weeks, mm-hmm. and he said that the case was not dropped because he didn't believe his client, but because, as you mentioned, of these time limitations.
But it's interesting that no media reported at the time in 2008. And in large part, I think, because of the questions raised about credibility.
Listen,
and his criminal history.
Yeah, and I didn't even know these stories, but I'm sure if I was, you know, in the know and covering Olympia in 2008 and heard this, I would be skeptical of it too. I mean, part of what's a little bit different is that you've had 10 more years. So Jeff Simpson, the Portland guy, was kind of just out of rehab a couple years in 2008. Well, he's kind of 10 years out of rehab now, actually sort of 12. He's gotten his life together. He's got a good job. So in some ways, you could say he's more credible. And also what's different is that now you have sort of this independent allegation in Seattle that is not connected, and yet the facts are sort of similar, suggesting some kind of pattern. So all that is kind of the reason why I think the journalists are willing to go with the story now.
Next, I want to talk about who is most likely to run the city of Seattle. Just before I leave accusations, I just want to give a chance for you to tell me what, and tell listeners, what matters most about this? I mean, because it could be about, is Seattle going to get a radically different kind of mayor? Because, you know, if it's somebody else, is this about Ed Murray personally? Is it about accusers wanting justice or wanting attention or whatever they want? Like, to you, it's a lot of stuff. What is this story most about for you? Anybody?
I mean, there are so many different stories, right? And I think CR and Natalie are probably better equipped to tell the political story. I'm not a political specialist.
All right, we'll get into that.
But for me, the story is about how we treat rape accusations in the public eye, especially against high-profile, powerful figures like Ed Murray, and what kind of tactics are used to discredit the accusers. And when you get to the point about why journalists in 2008 may have been skeptical and what's changed now, I think in addition to the points that you brought up, CR, the political climate has changed. Now it's not cool to point at someone's criminal record and say, well, that means you're fundamentally untrustworthy. And that was the argument that that Murray's lawyer was using back in 2008. But Jeff Simpson hasn't been convicted of a crime in more than a decade. He's living the straight life now with a family.
Let me just say one quick thing. It's maybe responsive. I think this is no longer just about sex. When you look, in fact, maybe not even about sex. If you look at Descartes' claim now, and you look at the mayor's hardened position, I mean, this week he said, I don't know this guy, never been with him, never heard about him, never spent any time with him. So he's got an unequivocal, kind of unambiguous position here. Descartes claims they were together 50 times. He's been in his apartment. I mean, he doesn't even have to prove sex, right? He just has to prove that there was some connection. Is there a picture with the two of them together? Is there someone that saw them together? I mean, maybe they
lots of people are together.
Right. But what I'm saying is the mayor has denied even that. So it strikes me that the mayor's credibility is on the line. If DH can just say, I can accurately describe every picture on his wall. I don't even need to describe his genitalia. If he can say I was in the same room, or someone can corroborate that, it strikes me as the mayor's credibility is going to be tough. Sex doesn't even need to be proved in the DH case right now. Just contact. Did he actually call him from jail? If there's a phone record that suggests several calls from jail between this guy and, I mean, I don't know quite how you prove it. Yeah. And Ed's phone. I don't know. I'm not saying you can. And it's DH needs to make that case. But you don't even need to prove sex, given what the mayor's now saying.
Mm-hmm. Back to your initial question, Bill. I mean, the story of the situation is multifaceted, right? It's a legal case, and that's what you guys are talking about. And then it's also becomes a political story as well, as it factors into the mayoral race, which heated up this week. And I know we'll be continuing to talk about that. But the point I was trying to raise at the beginning of the show is, how do you balance these two different things? Battling the legal case, fighting the allegations, also running a city, and then running for re-election.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about re-election. By the way, we've invited Mayor Murray to speak with us, and that hasn't happened yet since these allegations came out. And the invitation stands, Mayor. We hope you'll come on KUOW soon. The other part, and by the way, I'm with C.R. Douglas and Natalie Brown and Sydney Brownstone on the KUOW's Week in Review. And the other part of this is, Seattle's mayor seemed pretty firmly in control, and now that is cloudier. This week, Mayor Murray got more campaign challengers, the best known being his predecessor, former Mayor Mike McGinn. I asked McGinn on Monday, I said, you know, the voters had a chance to keep you on the job 3 years ago, and they said, no thanks. Why would they want you now?
Well, Bill, I've had a lot of time to reflect on that 3 years. And I think when I was in the job, I was growing in it. We got a lot done. we got a lot of support in that race, too. It was a very closely fought race. And I really appreciate who supported me then. You know, if you look at the demographic maps, it tended to be younger people and communities of color and renters that gave me support then. So I was really, you know, proud of that, frankly. And those are the things I care about. And those are the types of voices and the types of concerns that I'm trying to bring into the race.
So Mike McGinn says he has younger people, people of color, renters. Is he calling himself the anti-establishment candidate, Natalie?
Well, this becomes funny because there are multiple anti-establishment candidates. And the new question becomes, how do those several anti-establishment candidates split up the vote? You have Nikita Oliver, who announced way before the new allegations against the mayor surfaced. And she is running under the People's Party, a grassroots campaign kind of echoing some of the things that Bernie Sanders brought up in his presidential run. She might have that grassroots support. Then you have Carrie Moon, urban planner Carrie Moon, announce her candidacy this week. She was a former ally of McGinn in fighting the waterfront replacement tunnel. So now you have two allies running against each other, kind of appealing to the same base of voters. And when I ask this question, it seems like the candidates say that they'll find their own base and have different leadership styles. But how does that vote slice and dice during or ahead of the August primary, when only two of the 10 filed candidates will emerge as, you know, the two candidates in the general election?
CR, what's the main way McGinn is different from Murray on policy to you?
Well, mostly, if you base it on his statement at the announcement this week, he claims that Murray is too wedded to the elite. He believes the big housing bargain that was made didn't go far enough to require developers to put in affordable housing and to pay a development impact fee.
So he's more pro-develop. I mean, you remember Murray talked about densifying single-family neighborhoods, and there was outrage, and Mayor Murray backed off on that. I'm not sure yet how McGinn is different on that.
Yeah,
policy question.
Neither am I. And it's a weird kind of contradiction for McGinn because he's really kind of staked his reputation in this urbanist transit world. But at the same time, he's also known as a neighborhoods guy. And as you mentioned, Bill, a lot of the resistance to the mayor's HALA plan came from the neighborhoods. So I'd love to see more specifics from McGinn on how he actually plans to improve on the HALA plan, because I don't think he's offered up anything yet.
But one thing he said right off the bat when he launched his campaign is talking about tax reform and the idea of a city income tax or some sort of reform. That was brought up just last night by Mayor Murray at the first mayoral forum.
What did Murray say about a city income tax?
He said that he's going to send something to the city council in coming weeks, or that there's been a plan in the works, and that this kind of graduated income tax is needed. So we're still, I've been trying to get a hold of his people to get more details about the specifics here, but it's interesting that we're seeing lots of messaging echo one another.
I think McGinn thought he had him, had a good issue in income tax, saying, hey, we need to go that route and not all these property and sales tax increases, which have been going up quite a bit under Murray. Well, then Murray kind of just neutralized that last night with the surprise announcement that, hey, by the way, I'm for an income tax. So,
which may not even be legal, right? Wouldn't that have to go through the courts?
Yeah. Well, there's a question about whether we could even do it on a local level or whether it has to be authorized by the state. And then could the state fight us on that? And could it go all the way up to the Supreme Court? So
it has to do with the state constitution,
right?
And this ongoing legal question of whether it is constitutionally allowed in the state of Washington.
Right. But the point is that Murray doesn't actually have to do anything. He just kind of has to virtue signal that he's about an income tax, and it's no real political skin off his
nose. And that might be enough to not lose people to McGinn. It struck me that this announcement was pretty sloppy.
Which announcement? McGinn's entry into the race?
Very, very quickie, unorganized. I mean, he had no one there as supporters. He had two of his kids and his wife, and they seemed super unhappy to be back behind him.
This was at his house.
This is at his house.
On his lawn.
I mean, this was put together, it seemed like, in about 10 minutes. I mean, when you are making a run, especially a comeback for mayor of a city like Seattle, I mean, you do it in a big public way. You have a ton of supporters behind you. You have signs. I mean, the comeback it needs that kind of energy, and it had none of that. I mean, this is going to be a very, very difficult road for McGinn. It feels like a revenge run to me, a guy that is still smarting over his loss 4 years ago. It wasn't.
What do you mean it feels like a revenge run?
Well,
I mean, I see why it could be, but why do you? Why is it worth saying it feels that way? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's a charge. It's kind of a charge. What is it about?
Well,
it?
For me, because there was not a clear explanation of why he's running. Uh-huh. I mean, it was for a former mayor who's run the place, who has more detailed knowledge than any of his challengers and probably anyone else other than Ed Murray, to be as unspecific and unconvincing about why he was getting into this race and what exactly he would do. I mean, you know, maybe a new candidate can get away with that, but the hurdle is high for a former mayor. And to not be kind of out of the gate with a pretty clear agenda, pretty clear policy, pretty direct attacks on Ed Murray, pinning the blame of the city's problem on him, I sort of saw none of that. I didn't see what you need other than he's unhappy he's not mayor.
Well, there had been some chatter and rumors that he had been considering it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the timing became very interesting because it was post-allegations. So the question then becomes, did that prod him in that direction? Or was he going to announce regardless?
And why does that matter to the voter?
Well, because the two candidates, and I should say Carrie Moon, also has made it clear that she's been considering a run since January. And her consultant came out and said, you know, we have a candidate who's been considering it and will be announcing soon. That was right after the allegations surfaced. But now the question becomes, do these candidates think that Mayor Murray is less viable for his reelection, right? And do other candidates, mystery candidates that have not yet named, do they decide to also jump in the race because they sense an opening?
But why does it matter to the voter what they think the motives are or the campaign strategy are of the... Is this just inside stuff, or does this matter what we think they think about Ed Murray?
I mean, it's not a good look to pounce on a weakened mayor who's been accused of child rape, right? That doesn't really make anyone look like a noble, you know, defender of the public interest or whatnot. But
Seems opportunistic.
It does seem opportunistic. But the other thing is, I wonder if McGinn got into the race because he thinks he can beat Carrie Moon. And I wonder if he's overestimating his former base's love for him over Carrie Moon. I think that people actually want someone new in office, and I think he made a miscalculation there.
Carrie Moon, this engineer who, Natalie, as you said, also opposed the waterfront tunnel, is she the only one who's not calling for an income tax? That's a difference between her and Murray and McGinn.
She was the only one last night on stage during a rapid-fire Q&A when the moderator asked, would you be for a city income tax to test, you know, a state Supreme Court case, essentially, or test that angle? She was the only one who said no, but then put out a detailed statement as to why.
Yeah, apparently, I mean, she is on board with this idea that the taxing is too regressive in Seattle and doesn't like that trend under Ed Murray. Her solution is a capital gains tax, which you could say is an income tax of sorts on wealthy folks. I don't know why she goes to capital gains. Maybe she feels like it's legally defendable more than an income tax. I think it's pretty fair to say she's sympathetic with what an income tax is trying to do, given that she wants to tax capital gains. She's an interesting entrant into this race. As Natalie said, she and McGinn share a pretty similar base, that sort of anti-tunnel crowd, the sort of urbanist crowd. That's very much what Carrie Moon's background has been.
Housing affordability is one of her top issues. She put on her campaign website a proposal to quadruple the amount of affordable housing currently on the market to about 24%.
So she's very clear on the densify Seattle, get over. McGinn's slogan is keep Seattle, which I know he said means several things. He mentioned diversity and affordability, but to a lot of people, keep Seattle means keep Seattle the way we like it.
Yeah, it sounds regressive.
Maybe.
It also sounds incredibly half-baked. Like, there's supposed to be a word following Keep Seattle.
I mean,
they couldn't think of one, so they just settled on it, you know?
I mean, you know, Carrie Moon's problem is going to be she's very unknown. I mean, those of us who've sort of been covering politics know her. I've interviewed her a ton of times. She's been sort of in the mix, but she's not well-known citywide, never held a public office. I mean, this is a high reach for her. She strikes me as someone who has the background that's typical of a council candidate, not a mayoral candidate. I think the thing to watch, and you have basically a month until the filing deadline, what the establishment is doing right now, I can guarantee you, the chamber folks, sort of establishment labor, they are all scared to death of what may happen with the Ed Murray allegations. They could not handle another mayoral Mike McGinn. They aren't in line with a Carrie Moon. They're not in line with really anyone else that's in the race.
I mean,
the big nightmare for the establishment, if you will, is that if something goes bad after the filing deadline and Ed Murray, you know, kind of implodes, could happen, maybe, maybe not, but you would get Carrie Moon or Mike McGinn. I mean, that freaks out a lot of people.
Well,
that's a good. It is now more than half past the hour. We've talked about nothing else. So it's a. We got to pause it there. We haven't even talked about the Lorax, the trees, and more coming up on the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with, from The Stranger, news reporter Sidney Brownstone, from Q13 News, political analyst C.R. Douglas, King 5 political reporter Natalie Brand, and let's continue with the Week in Review now. A bunch of West Seattle homeowners cut down 150 city-owned trees to improve their views. I'm going to pause and let the shock of that sink in. Seattle trees clear-cut by private homeowners. Big leaf maples left lying on an environmentally critical slope. And the house in that Seattle Times photo looked pretty big, which, of course, makes it seem even more dastardly. Okay, so, wow. And then this week, the city settled with some of the homeowners for $440,000. City Council member Lisa Herbold said, that's a big enough penalty.
We have to make sure that our sanctions are significant enough to deter this activity in the future, and penalties have to be strong enough so that those with financial means don't see this as sort of a shortcut. Pay a small settlement and get your views.
I can't tell if half a million is a lot. The city has to restore trees, prosecute the case, send a message. How do you know these people can't afford the settlement? It's hard, right?
Well, they probably can't afford the settlement if, as you noted, the houses are what they seem from the Seattle Times photo. I think this is a clear an indication of why Pete Holmes, the city attorney who took on this case, basically hasn't had many challengers over his political career. He just is an effective guy. He took this case. He ran with it. He threatened criminal sanctions against these homeowners and civil sanctions, kind of forced them to start ratting on their neighbors, was able to get them to finally come out and admit. And you only have a settlement for some of the homeowners. There's still about six or seven homeowners that he's still putting the squeeze on. I expect that after this settlement, they will have to come out. In fact, their names are all now known to him. What's clear also, and this is what's so alarming about it, this wasn't just one homeowner.
Yeah.
In the past, we've seen one homeowner do these kind of things.
Yeah. Right.
This was a coordinated effort by probably six, seven, maybe 10 homeowners.
We're talking about the West Seattle tree cutting mafia.
Right.
There's a lot of gall in.
A lot of gall.
And you have to think about how awkward is it in that neighborhood.
Yes.
Because you have the one couple who was granted immunity for telling on their neighbors.
How do they still live together?
From The Wire. This is amazing. I love this story so much. And it's amazing the way that we've applied, like Pete Holmes has applied like this cloud of criminality over like these very ritzy West Seattle homeowners. Because, I mean, here we have a group of people who allegedly, because they settled, defacing public space, clear cutting 150 trees. And normally when we talk about criminality in Seattle and public spaces, it refers to the lower class.
Yes,
you know,
the criminal type.
Right, the homeless underneath the, you know, in the jungle under I-5, which, you know, nobody cares about, right? But now we have these beautiful trees that are clear cut and they're actually being held to account. Hey, rich people can be bad people too.
Right, right. How did they, you were talking about how they live together, like neighbor
no
against.
No more block parties.
No more block parties. It's like, but no one, I was surprised they all still live here. Like, It just seems, but nobody wants to move. The views are too beautiful.
Well, they are for now until some of this money gets used to replant the trees, which is what's going to happen.
Right.
One thing that is alarming here is that there was real safety concerns with doing this. I mean, this is a slope.
Yeah.
This was a land zone or a landslide area. And when you clear cut trees, you actually make the ground more vulnerable to slides. This could have done that. Apparently, there are people in houses and roadways under this area. So this isn't just a story about, you know, some trees that unfortunately got felled. This is actually a public safety story, too.
And it clearly was a pretty coordinated effort among the neighbors. So I think that brought it to a whole new level of the, you know, the potential criminal crime here and then the lawsuit.
I really want this to become an HBO miniseries or for the podcast Criminal to cover it. I think I just want to like, I want to, I wish I could see them in a room when the cops are like, okay, you know, we're going to offer you this sweet deal, but you need to rat on your neighbors. Oh, I would just, it's, the drama is amazing.
I want them to come on KOW. I am inviting you.
Good luck.
Because they have a side that I, you know, that their version of this is different from what people imagine when you say the West Seattle tree cutting mafia. So, West Seattle homeowners, I am inviting you to tell your side of the story because you don't look good.
I haven't heard from them.
Yeah, I mean, I there was some statements in the settlement saying we're sorry that we did this, we shouldn't have. So, I mean, that was, I'm sure, forced language that was negotiated. Mm-hmm. But whether they come on or not, I don't know. I think I've heard at least early on the claim was, oh, our landscaper did more than we asked him to.
Well, there you go. Because that kind of encroachment, it feels like a big, like less of a big deal, I'm guessing, when you've lived there decade after decade and it starts to, you trim the trees a little, it's good for the trees, it looks prettier. You know, it's just they don't, I can guarantee they don't think of themselves as monsters as they are being portrayed.
Tell that to the trees, Bill.
Yes. Fair enough.
They're not laughing now.
Just one quick thing of the deterrent effect.
The silence of the trees.
Yeah. This happened 10 or 12 years ago in Mount Baker. A U.S. federal judge actually was fined $600,000 for cutting down, I don't know, an acre of forest in front of his house to create a view. That was a pretty egregious situation. But the interesting thing is that deterrent lasted about, you know, 10, 12 years, and then suddenly another big example of it. So these deterrents work, but they do have a shelf life. I mean, people need to kind of be repeatedly reminded this is inappropriate.
Okay. Shall we just leave the trunks lying there for now?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
It'll grow back. By the way, I'm not referring to the Reputations, unless they come on KOW and plant a seedling. Okay, coming up on The Week in Review, let's talk about distracted driving, and maybe we'll get to Grasshopper Frappuccino. The Grappuccino, maybe, coming up. Stay tuned.
No?
KOW's Week in Review, still talking about insects. That's a good sign. That may be coming up. Let's talk about, by the way, with C.R. Douglas and Sydney Brownstone, Natalie Brand, when you're stuck in a traffic jam on I-5, 405, 520, 167, 522, I-90, any number of numbers, all of them bumper to bumper, your car is not moving, at least you can text your partner and say, I'll be late. At least you can check to see if your GPS has a faster route. You can type out the Great American Novel before you get over the ship canal. But this week, the state legislature passed a new, tougher, distracted driving law. Natalie, what do you know basically what's some highlights of the new law?
From what I understand, it would ban holding handheld devices while driving.
Right.
Right?
Because right now you
can leave it in your bag.
Yes.
Well, and this raises the question of, first of all, how easy or difficult will it be for an officer to actually get a visual of you with your phone in your lap?
Yep.
Right?
Because the current law, you can't text or hold the phone to your ear, but in the new law, you won't even be able to hold on to the thing and
grab
it while you're driving.
Use it as a GPS.
Yes.
Or, I mean, and this is a huge, distracted driving is a huge problem.
Yeah.
We've seen that it can be just as dangerous as drunk driving. Yet, I'm sure that everyone in the room is guilty at some point of having a phone in their hand.
Yep.
And I don't know, in practicality.
Unless you're Sidney Brownstone and don't drive.
I just want to say for the record, Bill, that I can drive. Okay. I just don't have my driver's license.
Okay.
I failed my driver's license test.
For the record.
Okay. For the record.
Thank you for clearing that up. You failed the driving test.
Well, my ego is too large to go back and retake it, such as my fear of rejection and failure. So, yeah, I lived in New York for 6 years, and I constantly took public transit, so I don't have my driver's license, and I'm constantly distracted, but I'm never driving. And this also has to do, I think the distracted driver upping the fines and the restrictions is a good idea. I mean, when my dad first taught me how to drive, he made me put my foot on the brakes, and he looked at me and he said, "Okay, Sydney, before you switch your foot to the gas, I want you to appreciate that we're sitting in a giant metal death machine. Okay,
oh.
You ready to go?
Yeah, you want to do this?
And I think if you've been driving for a really long time, and especially if you're stuck in traffic, you don't really appreciate that you're sitting in a giant metal death machine.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of, as you mentioned with the tree cutting thing, we kind of gradually become accommodated.
That's right.
To our surroundings. Or whatnot.
I just want to know in practice how easy will it be to enforce this rule?
Yeah.
Right? Because, I mean, you'd have to be caught at a light, right? Because I think that's where the majority of these offenses happen. If you're paused in traffic or sitting at a red light and you use your phone to text or make a call or check in.
That's not going to be okay, even at a stoplight. Yeah.
Not even at a stoplight. But enforcement is key because. It's fine to have a law in the books.
I mean, as Natalie said, this is the problem with respect to death. I mean, mm-hmm. traffic fatalities due to distracted driving in Washington are up 30%. I mean, that's huge. It's happening nationally, too. So, I mean, the legislature had to respond, it seemed to me, to this problem. And the last law we passed was the no texting law about 10 years ago. And look at the explosion of apps and other things you can do with these devices that is now on the scene. I mean, they literally had to do something to account for the realities of Instagram and FaceTime and Twitter and all the other things, navigation apps that people are now using phones for. I mean, in some ways, texting is not even the main problem.
Right.
But
so
Natalie,
holding the phone and looking at all the stuff you're looking at is a real problem. And
including a map or a navigation.
And this is an attempt to deal with that.
Yeah. Still, Natalie's question about how this is going to be enforced is a really, really good one because we know that driving infractions can be applied disproportionately. Unfortunately, to African Americans rather than white Americans, for example. So I think whenever we up the fines on a driving infraction, we have to be very conscious of that.
And by the way, I can imagine opponents in the legislature having said, who didn't like this crackdown, saying, come on, you're allowed to eat a hamburger while you drive. And the supporters said, yeah, let's ban that too. Because now, under this new law, if you are getting pulled over for something else, and the officer thinks you did that thing, you swerved or whatever, because you were eating a hamburger or putting on makeup, or in my case, shaving. Yes, that's right. I've done that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can get a ticket for that. So that's
right.
New as well.
If that behavior led to it. The difference that I hear, proclaimed here is that there is a cognitive distraction to these devices. So it's different from eating a burger or putting on your makeup or shaving in your case, that you can quickly snap back from those. They are a problem and they are a part of distraction. But when you're engaged in FaceTime or looking at your phone or texting, mm-hmm. the response time and the distraction cognitively is more significant and more severe, and the transition back is harder than just from mascara.
Yeah, so the world melts away.
That is what I hear.
You're in a different place mentally.
Want to do this over the makeup and shaving problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this has been, it's going to be signed by the governor. Like it's on the way. That's coming in the next few weeks or something. But there's a big lag time, so it doesn't take effect for almost 2 years.
I think it's 2019.
Yeah,
it gives people a chance to absorb this.
And then the penalty, is it 136 for the first?
Yes.
I'm reading a Seattle Times article that actually says Oregon is proposing something even more severe where it would be like a $1,000 plus penalty.
$1,000 plus
treating,
first time.
Treating distracted driving on the same level as drunk driving,
yep.
which would actually be a huge
maybe that's change. What it needs is a cultural change because I'm one of those guilty people you know, kind of doing what I can get away with. And I normal, like you were saying, Sydney, like you, I have normalized that in my mind. It's not okay, but it feels okay because I can and other people do. And it's so culture, take this away from me.
Well, I think it's also a question about how legislation catches up to technological advances as well, because as you mentioned, this is going to be implemented in 2019. Are we even going, are the majority of us going to be using smartphones in 2019? Are we going to be distracted by an entirely different type of technology by that point?
Like just an embedded screen. Right in the dashboard.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about distractions galore. Look at all the new technology that's coming mounted in cars, never mind the stuff you hold in your hands.
Not to mention, just one more point on this, it is also dangerous to be walking and texting across the street, which we see people doing all the time in the crosswalks.
Mm-hmm.
We are just more distracted than ever before.
I'm sorry. what were we saying? That I'm dumb. King 5. Political reporter Natalie Brand, Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas from The Stranger, news reporter Sydney Brownstone, and let's come back and see what we end up with when this week in review is done. I think it might be delicious. Okay, a couple of things I want to mention this week on The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. The top-rated host in cable news is out. That's remarkable. Fox News dumped Bill O'Reilly after The New York Times reported these sexual harassment allegations against him. What do you think? Is this firing going to matter in a month, a year? Is this a big deal?
I doubt it will. I mean, Fox has shown that it's bigger than its hosts. Listen, recently they lost Greta Van Susteren. They lost Megyn Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't affected their ratings. You know, 10 years or so back, they lost Glenn Beck. I mean, what's clear, it seems, is that this channel has a loyal following, and they're there for the ideology, and it may not matter who the host is announcing it.
But beyond the cable channel, I think it raises a really important discussion about the workplace, women in the workplace, and violations or alleged, you know, harassment like this. So I think
does it change the conversation, you think?
I think it's a positive that people are talking or having this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been having a lot of huge conversations lately that have been forced by, you know, national events or policy, from immigration to workplace harassment. You know, this is now being talked about 24/7 on cable news and in the national media. And I think it's an important conversation to have.
I don't think we should. I think that's really important too, Natalie. And I don't think we should pat Fox News on the back. I don't think we should pat ourselves on the back. I don't think we should pat Fox listeners on the back, because the time when this should have been relevant is back in 2004, mm-hmm. when the first sexual harassment case became very lurid and very public, and somehow no one cared, right? People only started caring, or the network only started caring, when advertisers started pulling out. So
Fox was trying to pull off some purchase that they needed regulatory approval for.
Right. This wasn't some kind of
huge important point.
Yeah, this isn't some kind of ethical feat or success.
I would say yes and no. I mean, sure, these have been around for a while, but I think it does represent a change. I mean, Roger Ailes was ousted about a year ago under the same with the same problem, and I think what you see is that the Rupert Murdoch children have taken over, and this is a new generation with a different sensibility. You know, his father's what, 90, something like that. I mean, these younger generation are not as tolerant of this, and if Ailes is going to go, then that really kind of created a new line for them about what's appropriate and what's not. And O'Reilly had to go based on what they knew about him, given that they had developed new policy after Ailes.
Okay, a couple different takes on what the conclusion is from Bill O'Reilly being no longer a factor. How can we go from Bill O'Reilly to bugs? To creepy insects.
Oh,
I can't think of a segue, so we'll just have to move on.
Degrees between that.
I think it's
so
pretty obvious.
This is a big. The story is that the stigma is over. You can now eat bugs, which people have been doing around the world forever. Actually, a shrimp is not far from a bug. But around actual insects, there's been this ick factor. And in fact, on this program last summer, I brought in crickets. I ate crickets. I explained how crickets are healthy and low resource and enviro-friendly, and I made my guests eat crickets, Rob McKenna, Joni Balter, Zeki Hamid. We're going to get over that. Eating bugs is just a matter of habit, right? It's just a matter of what you're used to, unless you're a vegetarian who won't eat crickets like Zeki.
But I am now, I guess.
See, you just ate it,
it's
so
crust.
We've...
Is it really a violation of being a vegetarian of eating bugs?
I really don't.
Okay, so he tried his best. Either you don't want to eat bugs because you don't care about the environment and resources and everything he told you, or you're now going to eat bugs and we're going to get past this whole I don't eat bugs thing. And we're past it. It was dumb and we're past it. Grasshoppers are on sale at Safeco Field and they're a big hit. They sell out all the time. Grasshoppers and lime juice and salt and cumin or something. Done, right? Things are weird until they're not, until they're normal.
I think they're in power bars too, right?
They're probably in power bars. I have seen bugs in bar form.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I won't be trying.
Although
them.
I haven't tried them. I have not tried the chocolate covered whatever they're selling at Safeco.
Chocolate cup. What are they selling covered in chocolate at Safeco?
I have no idea. Are they chocolate covered too, or are they with lime juice?
Maybe it's probably both.
Yeah, probably both.
I can't wait until I become a bug connoisseur. I had a water beetle at New in Capitol Hill, and it was so weird tasting. It was very, very salty and kind of fruity, and it tasted almost like beer. And I don't know.
Sounds great.
Well, it was an interesting taste for sure, but now I kind of want to try other bugs.
Yes.
Like you try different strains of marijuana, you know, like indica, sativa.
Right. Grasshoppers give you more of a mental buzz. Yeah. And with crickets, it's more corporeal.
Feel something in my legs, you know.
Since we're talking unusual food, can you talk about the unicorn frappuccino? There's a controversy over Starbucks
baristas.
Biggest,
most ridiculous hype kind of ever. What surprised
me... Is this all manufactured?
How did this even start?
The Unicorn Frappuccino is a new drink from Starbucks, and what strikes me as odd is that here you've got Howard Schultz, who's trying to be kind of a good citizen and a good steward of the world and, you know, and wanting to promote a healthy community and healthy lifestyles. He's coming up with a Unicorn Frappuccino. A grande Unicorn Frappuccino is 400 calories, 59 grams of sugar.
Terrible.
And it's unicorn because it has
spring. What are they doing offering that
kind
of
drink? And I've heard it isn't very good.
I don't know. I haven't tried it yet.
I don't know what unicorns taste like.
Well, they taste like sprinkles.
It seems very off-brand to me for Starbucks.
There's a headline that Katy Perry spit out a Starbucks unicorn frappuccino after one sip.
But the way it got to me is that baristas supposedly it's so high maintenance that they don't like to make it because they're in a hurry.
It's like the customers are in a hurry. Like a Slurpee cotton candy altogether. So they make these things and they get sticky. I mean, they hate making them. Apparently, this guy did so. Some pushbacks from the baristas, but it strikes me as a fad that I doubt is going to take off.
Mm-mm.
I'll try it, though. Try anything once. I will try grasshoppers on my unicorn, on the back of my unicorn.
They put beetles in that unicorn. I'm all in.
Okay. Sydney Brownstone is in. C.R. Douglas, you in?
I'm not in on either of those, actually.
Natalie Brown, that's just open up an extra chair. You're definitely in, right?
I'm going to pass. So.
You're not there. So Sydney and I are going out after the show anyway. The week in review on KOW.
You enjoy your lunch.
We will. KOW.
Sarah and I will go for a separate healthier lunch.
I must say the legal identification of this station. I'm legally required to say KOW. FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I don't have to say I love you all, but I do. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks for
having me.
Thanks for listening.